And thank you again to everybody that's read, that's helped us open the meeting, and take this opportunity to welcome those that have joined us since we first started. A huge welcome to any visitors to our meeting tonight, and a massive welcome to any newcomers that might be with us this evening. We hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. And we do have a speaker tonight, and I'm going to hand you over to Jay, who's going to introduce them. So Jay, over to you, my friend.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
I'm an addict. My name is Jay.
Hello, Jay.
Hi, Jay.
Hello, Jay.
The individual that's sharing tonight showed up on our doorsteps a little over a year ago. And she's become an integral part of this family, this group, and this platform. And I've watched her grow leaps and bounds from the individual that walked into these rooms. I've watched her take on projects and service, and it's been amazing to see her blossom in this time that she's been with us. And I will let her tell you her journey, because it is her journey. And I appreciate the fact that I've been able to watch that happen and unfold. So without further ado, Lisa, would you share with us?
Thank you, Jay.
Thank you, Jay. Hi, everyone. My name is Lisa. I'm an addict.
Hi, Lisa.
Lisa.
Hello. I'm like close to tears now, Jay. That was really nice. Thank you so much for that introduction. I was trying to keep my composure, but that's got the emotion flowing. Honestly, like, I'm shocked that I am here right now and that I'm doing the main share of this meeting. I've been coming to this meeting every single Saturday since I found NA this last year, and I've heard the most amazing shares, and I just didn't ever think I would be doing like a main share. I don't know, just I actually had to check with Steve and Jay on Monday, because I thought it was a joke, but apparently it wasn't. So here I am, although I must admit I'm kind of half expecting like a bucket of pig's blood to like drop on my head, you know, like it's all been a joke. No, I'm really grateful to have been asked to do this and be able to share a bit about myself and my journey with you guys. It really is such an honor just to be asked. I'm always really shocked when I'm asked to share. And it's really lovely. So I guess I will just start at the beginning. I am from Shetland. I've always lived in Shetland, except for like 5 years when I was at university in Aberdeen. And yeah, it's quite a normal place for me to live. Like, if, in my mind, it's a normal place to live. But it is very far away. I'm, you know, approximately 260 miles away from the mainland. That's to get to Aberdeen. But I've always lived here, so it doesn't seem that strange to me. I have two amazing parents that I love so much, and a sister that I love so much, and it's difficult for me to really talk about, because I love my parents to bits, but there was a lot of mistakes that were made and a lot of things that happened in my childhood that were not great. I had a lovely family home and I lived in a lovely area. So I've always felt guilty for the way that I feel, because I feel like I should be grateful because I have all this. But, you know, as soon as I was born, pretty much my family's kind of life kind of just got really toxic and dark. And I always feel like I've been anxious since birth, but maybe it was just that I was born into this situation that was quite tumultuous. There was my dad had a lot of problems with substance abuse, and we'd leave a lot, and my mum was having to work all the time because we were having like bailiffs knocking at our door, and my dad was in tons of debt, and it was a really the environment was very tense. And like our family kind of had this veneer of like everything's okay on the outside. Like we were never to speak about how we felt or like to ever let anybody know that there were problems. So I always knew to keep everything inside. And not only with everybody else, but also with my family. I was always trying to protect them from a very, very young age. I always wanted to protect my parents. I had extreme guilt when it came to my mom and my dad. I felt like it was all my responsibility. I suppose I probably blamed myself, in the way that children do. I just remember I had this just deep sense that there was something wrong with me, that I was wrong, if I was doing things wrong, and if I could just change the way I was, everything would be okay. I just didn't ever feel like a part of anything. I always kind of felt like I didn't belong, and I felt alienated. And I guess my solution to that was like, I need to be perfect. If I act perfect, if I look perfect, if I get perfect grades, if I do this, and then I'll be loved. So I guess perfectionism and people pleasing started quite early. And just a real like need to just protect my family at all costs. So inevitably it just came very easily to me to use external things to fill that void I felt on the inside. It was like food. I have had such a crazy relationship with food my whole life, and have gone through bulimia and anorexia and attention. That was another big thing that I craved from a young age. I always wanted to like make my dad laugh, or get my mum to notice me. And then once I got a bit older and I started liking boys, then it was always about getting attention from all the men. And it was a sad existence because I had no self-worth at all, and I craved all of these things outside of myself. I started smoking really young, and started drinking fairly young. I don't know the exact age I started drinking, but because like drinking in Shetland is really normal, and like people give their kids like a drink and stuff when you're really young. It's not really that strange here. It's a massive drinking culture, and people really look at you as if there's something wrong with you if you don't drink. So I think I was one of those people for a long time. I didn't understand how people couldn't drink. Drinking to me was like, oh my God, like relief. I all of a sudden had confidence, and I felt like I looked better and all of those things. Like it was just like the best thing ever. I didn't have to think about all of that stuff that was going on in my head all the time until the next day. And then, like finding like party drugs was a big thing for me as well. I really enjoyed all of that. I felt like that was like such a good solution because, if I took speed, then I didn't want to eat. So it was brilliant. So I would just take it all the time. And I did that all through my teens. And it was, yeah, it was just, I didn't realize that any of that was like addict behavior. It was only now I'm starting to see it. I just thought it was having fun. I thought people that didn't do that were weird, and it wasn't like what was wrong with them. I was never somebody that could just like, I always wanted the party to continue. So like I would be out for like a 4-day weekend, and I would be so annoyed when like I had to go home, and like everybody else I knew would just like they would get up hungover or coming down or whatever and just get on with their day, but I would need like downers and different medications to like get through that day. So I was always looking for stuff, and like I'd started like getting the medication from my dad at like, I don't know, 14 or something like that. But I mean, he would quite easily give it to me. So I mean, it didn't start off as me stealing from him, but that is where it ended up. So I don't know, I somehow made it through school and I got into university. I did not find school easy. I remember just feeling very anxious, very afraid. I had panic attacks all the time. But I didn't tell my parents that. My parents don't know that I've had bulimia and anorexia. Like, they don't know any of this stuff. So it's like, it was all of that was all stuff I kept really secret and to myself. And I lived with all this stuff my whole life just by myself. I found school really hard. I didn't ask for help. I didn't vocalize that I needed help. I just kept it all internalized. I somehow managed to get into university. I just scraped by though, really. And I actually found university a completely different experience. I loved it, and like the learning style worked better for me. And I was doing, like psychology and stuff I enjoyed, so maybe that was a big difference too. But I was still like drinking and partying the whole time. Sorry, I need to take a drink of water. I have to take a variety of medication and they all dry your mouth out, which is a lovely side effect. So yeah, I went away to university and I was doing my degree in psychology, and I wouldn't say I was having like my life was like happy and like all carefree. I was spending like thousands of pounds every month, like on clothes, makeup, my hair. I had to look perfect. I had to look perfect. Like that's all I could ever think about. And drinking or food or all of those things. I was spending all my money on it, and I was a very anxious person. I was very unhappy and I was very depressed, and I don't know, I somehow muddled through. I think what got me through is I really wanted to make my parents proud of me. I wanted them to be like so proud that I have this degree and then I could do this career, like perfect career, and then I would have the perfect family, and then my parents would like love me. Even though they did love me, but I don't know. It's just the way that my brain thinks. And my parents actually ended up getting divorced when I was in my third year of university, which was a big blow, and it was a whole big thing that I won't go into because it's a long story, but it was really jarring for me. And a year after that, I got very ill. I got like a virus, what do they call it? Epstein-Barr, glandular fever, I can't remember what it's called. And that eventually got better, but something changed with my health. Like I got really ill, but in a different way. And I didn't know what was going on. It turned out that I had ME, which is a very difficult to diagnose and very difficult to understand type of illness. And it was a really difficult road. My life imploded. It completely imploded. Because like all these things that I needed to do to make sure everybody liked me and I was perfect enough and I was going to be loved. Well, I couldn't do those things anymore. I all of a sudden could barely walk up the one flight of steps, like stairs, to get to my flat. It was really horrible and soul destroying. Like it was such a horrible and scary experience because nobody knew what was going on. Doctors didn't know. They didn't really care because all my blood tests seem to be fine. That's what they all, I'm really, really good at passing blood tests. Like they're always perfect. Like it was just like soul destroying to go through. I'd see doctor after doctor and they would just continually tell me like, just keep doing what you're doing, keep going to work, keep going to university, keep doing everything, keep walking. And I did do all those things and I kept getting worse and worse and worse until I could do less and less of these things. And then what the doctors did then was to prescribe me, like antidepressants and painkillers. And when I got the painkillers, I thought, this is amazing. Like this is a solution to like my everyday problem. Like I can take these every single day because they're prescribed for me every single day. You know, like it just seemed like such a magical solution to me, which is weird when I think about it, but it really did. And you know, I just slowly that kind of slowly is, you know, my life slowly, well, actually it was quite quick, but it was slow in the beginning. It just kind of started to snowball out of control. And, you know, it just began like 10 years of utter hell. So it turned into like, I was using these painkillers habitually every day, every few hours, like every, I say every few hours, but it was probably every hour towards, you know, towards the end. It was really severe and messed up. And I knew quite early on, like I would say 1, 2 years into it, I knew that I was an addict. I remember realizing that that's what was happening, but I did nothing to stop it. And after that few years, then, you know, my family started to cotton on to the fact that I was an addict, and it became really hard to hide. You know, because I'd been kind of hiding it well because I was living in Aberdeen and they were all in Shetland, but I had to move back home to Shetland because of my health and I couldn't work anymore. I had to leave my, I was doing my last year of university, doing my honours year. I had to give up halfway through, you know, like kicking and screaming. It was all, my life was just completely changing. But when I moved back home, it became really hard to hide the fact that I was like just an addict. I was using all day every day, and I couldn't like monitor it in front of people. Like I just had to do it. But this is like at the same time, my mum's having to get all my prescriptions for me. And then, you know, it's like then that slowly became that they weren't enough. And I would like harass my dad for medication, like his medication, like literally harass him. You know, and I ended up, I start to steal from him a lot because I couldn't keep up. I couldn't like sustain my addiction with the amount of, you know, medication I was getting prescribed. So I was stealing from him a lot. You know, it was really awful. Like I stole his house key from my sister, and I, you know, I would go in, and then one of them would come home. I mean, it was just awful. It makes my skin crawl just thinking about it. You know, to end up with, my dad got like a surveillance camera installed outside his house because it just gotten so bad, and out of control. Yeah, it was difficult. Like I would even do it when he was in the house. I would like go upstairs, pretend I was going to the toilet, and then I would like go and find like strips of tablets, medication, and I would like, and I knew he would know what I was doing, so like to avoid him ever like being able to get them from me, because that's all I really, I didn't, the only thing I cared about was that he couldn't take them from me, so I'd like put them down my trousers or in my bra or somewhere that he would never touch, like he would never do it, so I would do that. It was very painful to sit down, but that's all I cared about was just like getting what I needed to get in that moment. You know, it was very dark. You know, it destroyed like all of my family's trust in me. They just, I mean, I must have just been unrecognizable to them. And you know, I made out that, you know, I was, yes, I'm an addict, but it's only to painkillers. And so if I didn't take painkillers, I wouldn't have this problem. You know, like that then I wouldn't be an, I'm not like an addict addict. I'm just taking one thing and they're the problem. And also I have to take them because I'm in pain. So like if the only way I can stop taking them is if my health gets better. So that was my little lie to myself and to everyone else around me. And I did believe all that. I did. You know, denial. It was the thing is that I wasn't just taking prescription painkillers. Like I was completely like hooked on opiates. Like I could not survive without them. You know, like I had to have them every single day. But I would take any and every other drug I could get my hands on in the meantime, or as well as, or you know, it's just bizarre to me that I never realized that was a problem. You know, like I would, if I couldn't get my prescription medication. I would just like drink until I blacked out, you know. I was in a lot of denial. And you know, towards the end of my using, I even started smoking heroin, and I actually preferred my prescription medication, oddly. It was, you know, I suppose it's basically kind of the same chemical compound as heroin anyway, but it was it's probably a lot cleaner than the stuff you get here in Shetland on the streets. What was I going to say there? Yes, I can't remember. Completely lost my place there. I was using constantly. I'd found out how to like buy medications online. That was, I would order, you know, like 200 tablets, like from like five different places for over the weekend. You know, like I would just be buying tons of this medication, and that was great. You know, I thought that was amazing. Until it started to get harder and harder to get it. I got like blacklisted from so many places, like so many pharmacies, and I can't go anywhere in Shetland to get anything, like in a chemist or whatever. But also around the internet also. So I ended up getting my medication from a really dodgy site, and that is what happened to me. May of last year, I ordered medication online that came from a really, really dodgy company that, you know, that came with no medical instructions or boxes, just came in like a padded envelope with a few strips of the whatever. And I didn't even know what the medication was. I'd never heard of it, but I couldn't get what I wanted. So I read it. It said it was a narcotic, it was highly addictive, and I thought, perfect, I'll take that. I didn't read anything else about it. And this medication turned out to be something that is not legal or prescribed in the UK. And the dosage of one of the tablets was double the amount that a person would be prescribed in one day. So I was taking like one tablet was double what I should have been getting for an entire day. I vaguely remember getting that parcel in the mail, but I don't remember anything after that. And I'd overdosed, and I will say I did not think that I would overdose. Like I thought I was like above that. I think because I'd survived, like I was overdosing every single day, and I was surviving. So I just kind of, maybe I was a bit cocky, and also I really didn't give a shit if I died. Like it sounds like a horrible thing to say, but I really didn't care. I felt like I had no soul left. Like I just felt like I was dead inside anyway. So I just didn't care. But I most certainly did not want to go to hospital. So like that was the part that I didn't think about or bargain for. So the next thing I remembered was like waking up in hospital. No idea how I got there. No idea what was going on. I thought I had COVID. You know, it was like a few months into lockdown. And I thought I must have COVID. And when the nurses told me what had happened, you know, they said to me, you know, you've overdosed. I thought that they were lying. Like I was like, how could I have overdosed? I only took 30 of those tablets. Like I thought that that was such a small, minimal amount. Well, apparently it was enough to like kill an elephant is what they said. I don't know. They told me like it is an absolute miracle you survived that because we have no idea like how that even happened. You should not have survived that, like medically speaking. You know, you know, it was terrible because my boyfriend Danny and my mum, they found me, and it was really traumatic for them. I started to have seizures, and you know, it was a really horrible thing. You know, my mum had to watch me being put into a coma, and then watch me being I had to go to intensive care in Aberdeen. So but she wasn't allowed to go with me because of COVID, and so she had to watch me being taken in to, like the ambulance and driven to the emergency plane so that I could go so I could be flown in a coma down to Aberdeen and put into the intensive care unit. You know, she thought she was never going to see me again, because that she'd been kind of warned, like We don't know. We don't think she's going to survive it. And even if she does, we don't know what kind of brain damage she's going to have. That's what they told her. So, you know, they went through an awful lot. They went through an awful lot with me the whole time. But I mean, it was a very traumatic thing for them. The only traumatic part for me was waking up in hospital. The rest I don't remember. So, you know, it was really scary. And it, do you know what it really did? I think now that I've been a part of NA for a while, like I now realize what I had in hospital was a sort of spiritual awakening, because I woke up in hospital and yeah, I was terrified. And you know, I remember the nurse saying to me like, "Oh, you've detoxed in the coma," which, I mean, I guess that was a good thing because I was never prepared to detox. You know, I kind of resigned myself to just like staying on drugs so that I didn't have to deal with any of that stuff. But even though I detoxed, I still had to go through withdrawals and everything. So I mean, it wasn't amazing, but it was at least it was something. And I just felt like it. I just felt like in that moment, I woke up. I woke up. I woke up literally and I woke up figuratively. I woke up to the fact that I was destroying myself. I thought, how have I got, like, how have I let my life get so out of control that I don't care about what I'm putting in my body? Like, it suddenly became really clear to me how reckless I had been with myself and the stuff that I was taking, and it, in a way that I had never, oh, somebody's got their mic on. In a way that I'd never, can't remember what I was saying. In a way that I'd never looked at things before. Like I really saw things for what they were. I felt so exposed and like vulnerable. Like I knew that like everyone could see what was going on. Not, I mean, they could anyway before, but it was like a real moment of like, holy shit. Like, what have I been doing? And I felt so bad for what I put my family through, you know, for the last 10 years, and how worried and upset they all were, and how scared they were. You know, they all thought I was going to die, and it was a really like humbling experience to go through. You know, it was just, yeah, it was crazy. I remember just like lying in the hospital bed and, you know, I was in the psych ward and I wasn't allowed to go to the toilet without closing the door, without keeping the door open even. You know, I had to like do all these things because they thought I'd tried to kill myself. And I remember all there was these other women on the ward, and it's the one thing that always makes me super emotional. But it was these people had no one, like they really didn't have anyone. You know, they were phoning people to try and come and like get them, because you needed to have like somebody to come and take you out. Like you couldn't go out on your own. You had to have, I think of the word. And it was really hard to see these, like just this one girl was just screaming, like begging her mum to come and get her. And like it was so sad. And at the same time, my mum was phoning my phone, just like desperate for me to be able to come home. My dad was on his way to Aberdeen so he could come and take me home. And I just felt so grateful in that moment that I have people in my life that love me. Because so many people, you know, they don't have that, you know, with their parents or their sister, and like all these relationships I really destroyed. They still loved me, and like it's just that it was one of the most powerful things I ever felt, was the amount of love and gratitude I felt in my heart for my family in that moment. And I thought, like, if I can just do this, like, I just need to try and do this. I need to try and stay clean. I was so miserable at the end. I was so miserable, and I was making myself so ill. You know, I already had my illness to contend with, but now I was actually making myself so much more ill. I didn't know how to stay clean, and I didn't think it was possible. And that's the honest truth. I wanted to do it, but I didn't think it was possible. And I had to stay at my dad's in isolation because I had to go back and be quarantined or isolated for like 2 weeks. Once I got back and to Shetland again, and you know, that kept me away from drugs because I was basically like I had to stay in one room and I wasn't allowed anywhere. And that was a good thing for me and my dad's relationship, actually. Like I'd stay there for 2 weeks, and he had to speak to me, and our relationship had become very strained. I know he loves me. It's really difficult to explain. I know he loves me, but he's not capable of giving a lot because he's got a lot of mental health problems, and he cannot be there consistently. Plus, I also destroyed our relationship by stealing from him constantly and manipulating him constantly. I would tell him, if you don't give me what I want, I'm going to commit suicide. Things like that. I would say that to him so that he would give me what I wanted. So it was like I really did destroy our relationship. So it was a really good thing, but it was one of the scariest. That was the scariest 2 weeks of my life. That and the hospital and that, it was terrifying. I felt like this little bunny rabbit was just blinking with big wide eyes. I couldn't talk about the hospital. I couldn't speak about any of it. I didn't want anyone to tell me anything. I just wanted to breathe and get through each minute. I was terrified, and that was, I guess, the first time, because I was the first time I didn't have drugs. But each day I started to think, I'm not going to be able to do this. How am I going to do this? I tried to get some help with the mental health team here in Shetland, and they don't have much to offer service-wise. And they said to me, the only thing we can offer is, you can get counselling if you're on a methadone script or another methadone or some other script. They gave me options, and I said, well, you know what, I'm clean, so I just really don't want to do that right now. I don't know how I managed to say that, because honestly, that is insane. That's exactly the sort of thing I would have been looking for normally. So for some reason I didn't, I said no to that. I turned that down. But then I thought, well, what the hell am I going to do? And I went to the search engine, and I typed in help for addicts in Shetland. First thing that came up, the number one thing, was HIGNA, the Highlands and Islands Group of Narcotics Anonymous. And it never occurred to me that I could, NA was something I could go to. I didn't really understand really anything about it. And I knew more about AA because it's very big in Shetland, because there's a lot of alcoholism. But there's also a lot of addiction in Shetland, and they're not any. So I mean, it's just the drinking culture is just more accepted here. But yeah, I really didn't know anything about it, and I wasn't too sure. But I thought I would. I thought, well, what else am I going to do? I was desperate, and that is it was the it was absolutely the gift of desperation. I was desperate. And the first meeting, it was a Sunday, and I have no idea how I managed to get to that first meeting. I just had to click on a link. I don't mean physically get to it, but I have no idea how I managed to do that, mentally, because I remember I was shaking, I was dripping in sweat, I was so scared, and I was so afraid to open my mouth and say anything. And I really don't remember that much about that first meeting, except I remember people's voices. So I have a kind of a vague outline of who was there now that I know people more. The one thing I remember is being bowled away, completely floored by the honesty that I was hearing. What I was hearing was so, it was incredible. All these things that I'd felt inside buried deep. Deep down, so that I kind of even forgot that I felt them. I was hearing people speak about things that were that it was the same things that I felt, or the same things that I'd gone through or did. People spoke honestly about their addictions and how, the lows that it brought them to, and that's what I identified with. I was like, holy shit, there are other people like me out there. This is I actually still am surprised by this all the time. I'm always blown away by the therapeutic value of one addict helping another. I'm so it just impresses me on so many levels, how much that helps. But that was what I remember from my first meeting. And everybody was so kind to me. I remember thinking, like, what is going on? Why are these people being nice to me? Like, this is really weird. Like, everybody would say these nice things, like, oh, we're so glad you're here and keep coming back. And I was like, keep coming back? Like, what? How? What, can I not just come here once and you can tell me what to do and then I can get on with my life and be happy? And then, but no, that wasn't it. And then, like the total abstinence thing, that freaked me out because, like, one of my first thoughts when I got home from the hospital was obviously, like, when should I start drinking again? Because I had stopped drinking for years. I didn't care about alcohol anymore. And that was one of my first thoughts, was like, I wonder when I should start drinking again. Like, that was what I was legitimately one of my, like, serious questions. So that I was a bit like, ooh. And I also was like, ah, right, they want me to keep coming back because they want my money, because I saw the Tradition 7 thing and I thought, like, okay, you guys want my money. But then it wasn't that either. I could not understand it. I thought maybe it was like some sort of like kind of religious cult type thing where it was like, because I could never seen people really that happy except like maybe in church, which I haven't really had that much experience in, but you know what I mean. I was just really surprised by it. I did not know why anybody was being nice to me or why anybody would want me to come back. I mean, at that point in my life, I felt like just the most disgusting human on the planet, just like the dregs of the world. So I mean, it was incredible. And I think what did keep me coming back was the honesty. But also, what was really important in that first meeting, one thing that was super important was I met my sponsor, my future sponsor at that time, on that meeting. And I swear, like, she came into my life like an angel. And she gave me her number at the meeting, and quite a few people did. I gave her my number too, but she proceeded to call me like the next day. So if I was hesitating about going to another meeting, she called me the next day and just was chatting to me and like kind of giving me a bit of background on what she's like, what how she's gotten through and like her life in recovery, and just made me feel like I was somebody that was deserving of like being like having a conversation with. I mean, I didn't know how to talk to anyone or like answer any questions. I'm sure the conversation was not very riveting for her, but I remember just feeling like, oh my God, somebody wants to talk to me. And that is one of the things that kept me coming back, like that the next meeting. I'm so grateful to my sponsor for that. Because I needed that. I needed that kind of push. I needed a little push. I did. I still do a lot of times. I needed that. I think I could have easily just hidden, run away, because that is what I wanted to do. There's just all these things that happened in the time from waking up in hospital to, finding NA that there are must be higher power moments. And it's one of the reasons I was able to believe in something greater than myself because of all these experiences, because I knew that there was something else that was guiding me at that moment, because I was going to meetings, but I was so scared. I didn't want to open my mouth, but I would share somehow. I would share. I was very, like, afterwards, very self-obsessed and worrying about what I said, but I did share. And I started to do the suggested things. I still can't even believe I asked my sponsor to be my sponsor. I was gonna like be really brave and do it on the phone. But then I got really scared at the last minute, so I texted her afterwards and asked, like, would you be my sponsor? And then another message afterwards, like, don't worry, you don't have to if you don't want to, no pressure. Like just all of these all these things after it, because I was so embarrassed. And she was just like, yeah, of course, like phone me every day for the next 30 days. And she gave me all the kind of suggested things, like go to a meeting, go to a meeting every day, go to more than one, and start reading the literature. And we started doing step work after a little while, and speaking to other people, making connections with other people in the fellowship, which was my most scary thing, because I'm really afraid to call people, ask for help, accept help. I find that all really, really difficult. And as I'm sure most people do, I think I'm the only one still. But that was the hardest thing for me. But all these things, they did slowly kind of add up together. And my recovery has all been online. Like, I forgot to mention, like, there isn't, yeah, no, I maybe did mention it. There is no NA in Shetland. Like, we don't have that here currently. Like, yeah, I mean, I get now that I could start setting that up, but the other problem is that I'm housebound and I'm pretty incapacitated, for lack of a better word. Like, my body is exhausted and weak most of the time, and I have to lie down for most of the day. So, online recovery for me is where it's at, because I'm in my bed right now, and I can do this main share. I can speak to all of you guys. I can come to meetings. I can do service. I can do it all from now my laptop, which I'm very excited about, but I could do it all from my phone, like my tablet. Like, it's incredible to me that there is this out there. I never knew about it, but I mean, I wasn't looking for it either. So it's like that kind of attraction rather than promotion thing, that it says about in the traditions. I think it's traditional living. I might be wrong, actually. But it's like I was like attracted somehow to this program, but I don't even know how it happened. It was all just like all these things that went right. I wasn't supposed to live, and yeah, here I am. There's all these things that are just seem so incredible to me. I think like being in the coma, like, and that whole near death experience, I think that really opened my eyes up and my perspective, so that I was looking at things differently. That was a really big thing for me. Kind of it opened my heart up to love. I knew when I got out of the coma that I was guided and protected and loved. I can't explain to you why I felt like that. It was weird, because that wasn't the things I was normally used to feeling, but I did feel all of those things. And so, like, it all kind of worked to this moment that I'm, that I found NA, and slowly I realized, like, oh, I can do this. The more meetings I went to, the more I started to realize why I can't drink alcohol, because alcohol is a drug. And even if I don't get have a even if I don't become addicted to alcohol like I was to prescription medication, it's still going to lead to nothing but bad stuff. Like, I was a terrible drinker anyway. I acted like an absolute idiot when I was drinking. I always drank too much, and I started to realize it was good hearing that message in the meeting every day, in the readings every single day. I started to think, like, I get it, like, I get this, and all of these things, like, they start to click into place. I think, like, I sometimes feel self-conscious because I want to say, like, I've been in recovery for a year and now I've got this job and I've got like three kids, and I don't have any kids. I don't know why I said three, but you know what I mean? Like, I want to have like all these. I've been brought up to think external is like what's important. And so there is a part of me that feels self-conscious about my life and what it looks like. Because I'm disabled and I have my health issues and I can't do that much. However, I'm actually almost grateful for those things, the health stuff, because it has gotten me to really start working on my internal and like look inside of myself. The things I've gained in recovery might not be like outward things that I can show people, but like what I've gained is, like choices. I can make a choice today about whether I want to like use or not, or whether I want to like go to a meeting or not. I've got choices. I'm not like dominated by this force of addiction in the way I was, the obsession and compulsion. I'm like, I've got this like burgeoning kind of self-worth and self-acceptance, that's going on. I'm becoming comfortable with myself, with who I am. I'm grateful for all that I have, instead of like looking at all the things I don't have. I did that for years. I was like angry at all the stuff I didn't have and bitter at the world. But now I feel grateful for what I do have. Like, I've got a home. I have people that love me. I've got I've got my beautiful cats, and I've got you guys, you know. I've like got this whole new family, and you're all online. My sponsor I met online, and we speak on the phone, and my friends in NA are all around the world, and I speak to you guys on like messages and on the phone, and it's not the way that maybe most people have done it in the past, but it's the only way I know it, and it's the best thing ever. I've got all these amazing friends, and like you guys feel like my family. I'm really super super grateful for Higna, and I just want to say a massive thank you to Steve for setting Higna up, for looking, for knowing that there was that, you know, that people like me and on the islands needed help. Thank you and Debs and Jay and, you know, everyone that helped set it up, because it's such an amazing thing. And I just want to say thank you to all of you, my Higna family, because you all carried the message to me. You all did. And you all had a part in saving my life. And I will leave it there. Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you.